welcome to the final session in our What's the Economy For Anyway series that you thought it would never end. But anyway, here we are, and I've created a few resource sheets for people to ask me about some of the things that we mentioned here, websites, books, and contact information, both for Dave Backer and myself. So we'll pass these around. You may find something useful on them. Given what we're talking about here, I saw an ad which I had saved for a while. I thought this was sort of an interesting notion of where what makes us kind of different as a country from some of the other countries that we talked about. It was a full-page ad. It's a free country, but have you felt like that lately? Has the torch of liberty gotten a little dimmer? Is it starting to feel claustrophobic inside the safety net? Do we still live in the home of the brave? As long as there are people willing to ask the question, we'll do our part to make sure that Harley Davidson is the answer. So. Their new slogan is "Screw it, let's ride." And freedom ain't quiet. So freedom equals noise. But anyway, this is kind of the whole thing. Everything can kind of be turned into an ad. And the notion is that don't talk to us Americans about social obligations and getting together to do things together, because we are rugged individualists and we will do whatever we feel like doing. So, if you've been at some of these sessions, you know that we talked about our idea about what the economy should be for, based on Gifford Pinchot, the first director of the Forest Service, thinking that the purpose of the economy was the greatest good, which we defined as quality of life, for the greatest number, which we defined as fairness, social justice, economic opportunity, over the longest run, which we defined as environmental sustainability, being sure that things were around for future generations. So now it comes down to, what are some of the things that we can begin to do if we want to change things? For people who are at some of the previous things, is there anything particular that sort of stood out, any problems or any things that we talked about that maybe felt stronger than we heard, that you may have resonated to with more, or maybe not, than other things? I just want to give folks an opportunity if they want to make any comments. Yes, Ron.
John, we talked about many things that we can do, and probably you'll give us a good number list. One question I have is, are there criteria for choosing among them as the most important, get us the farthest, can be done quicker, sooner, or something like that?
Yeah, okay, well, let's talk about that. That's a good idea. Dave will probably get to some of that in his part of this discussion at all, at the end of the second part of the discussion. So first of all, though, I want to talk a little bit about personal things, because I think we all want to know a little bit about what we might think about doing at a personal level. And I did talk earlier, some of you were here for the happiness discussion, and we were talking about getting your community involved and your friends involved to kind of create a happiness initiative and see how happy your community is and what you can do about it. If people are interested in that, please feel free to email me and I will electronically send you the links and all of the material that we have in our Seattle Happiness Initiative. Now, secondly, on time, which is one of the issues we looked at as being a place where the happiness research has shown that Canadians, Americans, people in industrial societies feel like the least like they have what they need and here. So we've seen that. One of the things that I recommend is that when you go back, that you even for a day or for a week, kind of keep track of where your time is going, where you're spending your time. And what people do in these studies of time and happiness is that they rank their activities. So, know, you have breakfast. This is your day. And then you have your commute in the morning. And then you have work. And then you have things associated with work, like lunch, like socializing at work. You may spend a little time at the so-called water cooler. And then, you know, the end of work and the commute back, dinner, family time, etc. And if you separate these things, see how much time you spend on each of them, and then score each of these things, basically how you feel about when you're doing them, how you feel when you're doing them. What people do is they rank these things kind of between 1 and 5. 1 being a sort of undesirable part of my day, and 5, it's a desirable part of my day. And then kind of see if where you're really not spending time on the things that are desirable, and if there are any ways that you can change that, what you might do to give more time, say, to what some of the things that come up are family and socializing with friends and all of those. Are there ways, if those are the things that turn out to make you happiest, that you can spend more time doing those things? These little exercises are good. People do it about money also, keeping track of your spending. People find that if they keep track only for 1 month of everything they spend, and they look at where their money is going, they find that they can often save 20% or so, even people who don't make that much money. One thing we certainly can do in Heidi, Storl talked about this yesterday for those of you who were in her philosophy and ethics session. Of course, we know that generosity is one of the things that makes us happiest. It's also one of the things that's most needed in our world today. So I was just doing a little bit of calculation, and Heidi talked about putting a penny aside a day, but what if we put a latte aside a day, and a lot of people drink lattes or have a latte each day. What does a latte cost about?
Depends on the size.
Yeah, it does. Let's say this is a cheap latte. Let's say $2.50, okay?
Oh, I'd go even cheaper, $2.
You got a $2 latte?
We don't like those.
Yeah, okay. I'm gonna be arbitrary and make it a $2.50 latte. Now, about how many adult Americans are there?
Uh-huh.
So we don't necessarily have to make kids contribute, although kids like to contribute. But they're not drinking the lattes.
135 million.
Adults.
135 million.
More like 200 million.
Adults?
Adults, yeah. Over 18. Yeah.
Not all of us drink lattes.
And some of them aren't capable of drinking it because they're old.
No, I'm not saying all these adults drink lattes, but let's say they can.
The others have to put aside a beer.
Let's say you have, let's say you have
about
200 million people over 18, about another 100 million people under 18. We take these people and we multiply the 200 million adults, even whether they drink latte or not. Maybe they drink a beer, maybe they drink something else, you know, they get an extra vegan burger or something like that. I don't know what. So you multiply those. What do you get per day?
Starbucks going broke.
It's Starbucks going broke. Well, yeah. What do you get? You can still, you know, you can give up something else if you don't want to. If you don't want to wants to see Starbucks suffer. But so how much is that?
$500 million
a day. Okay. So that's a day. We put aside $500 million. Now, how many days are there in the year? Roughly 365. And who wants to do a quick calculation? $500 million a year times 365. About how much money is that?
They pay for health care.
Pardon?
We pay for health care.
No, not quite. But we spend about $2.3 trillion a year on health care, so a lot of money.
That's 100.
But this is about $182.5 billion, okay? That's what, if each adult, say, put $2.50 a day into a fund, you know what the average income per day is for Americans? So this is everybody. This counts kids, I mean, everybody. Some people are making a lot more than this, but when you simply divide all the income that Americans earn in the course of a year by the total population, anybody know about what that comes out to?
Some
around $30,000 individual for a family of four per year.
Actually, when you do all of it, it's higher than that. It amounts to about $100 a day per American. So about $100 a day per American. So what we're talking about here is about, you know, and again, people who are wealthier could contribute more, and people who have less can you fit? But if people put in 2.5, that's 2.5% contribution. And that amount of money, $182.5 billion. The estimates are, Heidi mentioned these yesterday, I'll mention them again. The estimates are that we could end hunger around the world, and that amounts to about 20,000 to 30,000 deaths a day of people. We could end that in 10 years with an expenditure of about $13 billion a year. So, just think of that. In fact, that $182 in 1 year spread out over the 10 could do it, could end world hunger as we know it. We can probably give everybody safe and clean drinking water in the world for a total of about $20 billion spread out over a period of time. So when you put some of these together, you can see how valuable not only generosity can be, but how far it really could go to help solve some of the most serious problems that people are facing around the world. And we also have hungry people, as we know, in the United States as well. I would argue that it might also buy us a little more security around the world, that people might appreciate this, and that the stature of the United States would be increased if the money were put into this. And of course, you don't put this into by sending food somewhere. There are various ways that this can be used that help people become more self-sufficient in food. But it's just an example of what we can do. If we were to choose to consume a little bit less, devote a little bit more money to generosity, some of the other things, of course, that we can do personally, how many of you at least buy some fair trade products when you see them? Some of the churches, how many of your churches have ever bought fair trade coffee, for example, as a matter of practice? Some of you have. Very important thing, I did a film called Buyer Be Fair about the fair trade movement, and it's not perfect by a long shot. Like anything, it has its flaws, and there are, you can find examples of corruption, and you can find, but you have, it I think has an enormous positive effect. And so buying those kind of things, shopping consciously when you're going to shop, and where you can contribute to sustainable products, fair trade products, all of those things are very important. And of course now increasingly being willing to maybe spend a little more money to buy local where possible. How many of you are connected in any way with a CSA? Maybe you've heard of a CSA. Do you want to tell people what that is?
Well, we're not in the CSA right now because we have a farmer's market that goes year-round, so it's easy.
Where are you with a farmer's market that goes year-round?
Well, we have a lot of canned products and baked products in the winter. We're in Ohio.
Okay.
But from starts in April and goes through October. But the CSA is Community-Supported Agriculture. Uh-huh. And when we were in that, we got an allotment every week. And we had two different ones. There was at one time they delivered it actually to our house, and another one we went and picked it up at the farmer's market or near the farmer's market. And whatever was growing is what you got. I bought a vegetable cookbook to cook some of the things I'd never heard of in my life. And I thought I was so knowledgeable about all the fruits and vegetables.
And what does the CSA do? And that's exactly right. I mean, it's a farm, and people buy little shares each year, and then the produce comes to them when it comes out. What does it do for the farmer? Provides some initial capital. It helps. It creates something of a risk pool for the farmer, so that, you know, in good times the farmer may not make as much, and you're going to get a lot of food. They'll make plenty, but you will get lots of food. But in hard times, when the farmer is having trouble, yes, you're going to get a little bit less, but the farmer will still be able to continue operation. So some of these kinds of CSAs are making for great positive changes. Only recently, in the last 10 years, for example, in the state of Oregon, the number of farms has doubled. It was after a long period in which, we were losing farms. Now we are actually, in many states in the country, starting to gain smaller farms. And these kinds of things, close to the cities, they help preserve the farm land, they help the farmers, and you get out of it good, higher quality, usually organic, certainly not highly chemicalized foods. Mm-hmm.
In Minneapolis, where I live, CSAs are really popular, and the art community has kind of latched onto that idea, and they started community-supported art. And so they're doing the same thing and just sending out boxes of art, like it's music, jewelry, whatever, like the artists who submitted work. So it's kind of cool that other industries are like doing the same thing, you know? It's a great idea. It works well.
Marvelous idea that people can do. And how many of you have communities where there are any kind of time banks and time dollars and things where people share through? Did you?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say about for church folks too. I mean, just having a garden, you know, having a garden at your church to grow, you know, to grow fruits and vegetables is really, and a lot more churches are starting to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so there are a lot of these kinds of things where. I won't go into a lot of them now, but these are the kinds of things that you can, in a sense, do immediately. Now, I'm connected with the organization Take Back Your Time. Some of you may be aware that our website is on the sheet that went around. It's timeday.org. And we celebrate, not nearly as much as we used to. We started out having actually more activity around the day than we do today, but it's Take Back Your Time. Take Back Your Time Day is October 24th each year. We chose that day back in 2002 when we started Take Back Your Time because it was a Friday that fell 9 weeks before the end of the year. And it symbolized what at that time was the average difference between the amount of hours worked by Americans in a year and the amount of hours worked by Europeans. About 350 hours or 9 weeks more than Americans were working. So the idea was October 24th. If a European had worked by October 24th as much as Americans had worked by that time, they would have the rest of the year off, essentially. So this was the concept. But this year, October 24th falls on Sunday. And this has happened once before, in which case many churches used it as a time to kind of talk about time for them and for their families and about the Sabbath and the loss of the Sabbath and these kinds of things. You can get excellent resources if you're interested in doing this with your church for this day. You can the Massachusetts Council of Churches has cooperated over the years. It's a little less so now. It's kind of faded a bit, but initially with Take Back Your Time, and they produced a lot of materials for their churches in Massachusetts to talk about this issue of time. And that material is available on their website, which is masscouncilofchurches.org. And if you go to their website and then just, used to be front page. For many years, it was right on their main page. Now you have to type in Take Back Your Time in their search, and the stuff will come up. But they've done a lot of it, so I recommend that as something that you can do. Now I'm going to talk just a tiny bit about a couple of policy ideas that I think are valuable because they are bills that are in Congress right now, and they are bills that can give us more time in our lives, some of the things that we were talking about, and I think also improved health. The first of those is the family leave bill from Pete Stark, congressman from California. And this would make the Family and Medical Leave Act, which is now 12 weeks of unpaid leave if you have a child and covers only companies with 50 employees or more, this would make at least a portion of that time be paid. And that's important because many low-income people, if a little bit of that that time off isn't paid, they simply can't afford to take it. That bill has almost no chance of passage, I will say that right now, but that is something to be thinking about and talking about. The second one, which does have a very high chance of passage, is the Healthy Families Act. And that was a bill created by Senator Edward Kennedy before he died, and that bill would give Americans 1 week by law of paid sick days. And right now we are virtually the only country in the world that doesn't guarantee any paid sick days for workers. Most workers get some paid sick leave, but about 40% of American workers, a little more than 40% of American workers, have no paid sick days. And this is particularly a problem in what industry? Anybody know?
Farm service.
Agriculture. Service in the Walmart type industries.
Walmart is a part. Yeah. Which one that really might affect you?
Food industry.
The food restaurant, particularly the restaurant industry. So about 86% of people who work in the restaurant industry get no paid sick days. So what that means, and many of them are low income people, which is lower income folks who are least likely to have this. Is, of course, what is so? What might that mean?
They work.
They come to work and they pass you your burger or your vegan, whatever it is, you know, whatever your preference is, and you know, you get sick. And as we talk increasingly about things like H1N1, and the president says, when you're sick with this kind of thing, stay home, keep your kids home when they're sick, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's all great, and we need to do that, but that's often very hard for some people who get no paid sick days at all. In fact, we literally have thousands of Americans who are fired every year because they took a paid sick day, or particularly a day to care for a sick child. So the Healthy Families Act, I think that one has a decent chance of passage. The third one is the Work Sharing Act, and that's based on a law in Germany called Kurzarbeit, or short work. And that particular act, bill by Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island and Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, would use federal unemployment funds to pay companies to shorten work hours rather than laying workers off. So, for example, workers could work 4 days a week and then they would receive unemployment pay on the fifth day. Some states already allow that. Washington State is one of the states that allows that with its unemployment funds. The problem is that most of those states are out of funds and dependent on the federal government for unemployment funds, and federal funds are not allowed to be used in that way. Work sharing in Germany has prevented German unemployment from increasing at all. I mean, there's been a rise of 0.2% in the German unemployment rate since the recession began, mm-hmm. compared with about 5% in the United States. So when it was proposed in Congress, there's bipartisan support in a sense for this bill, in that liberal economist Dean Baker, who was pushing this, testified in Barney Frank's House Finance Committee in favor of this, but so did Kevin Hassett, who is the chief economist for the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank. The Republicans brought Hassett in to testify, thinking that he would testify against the bill. They were very surprised to find out that, in fact, he testified in favor of the bill and said that this is working in Germany. It works for the employers because they don't have to get rid of people and rehire them. It works for the workers, and it doesn't really cost much more, if anything more, than the traditional unemployment thing. It's kind of win-win-win, so why wouldn't we do it? Well, it didn't move anybody. Not a single, there's still not one single Republican in favor of the bill, and there are still quite a number of Democrats who are not in favor of the bill, so the bill is really stuck. But this is one of the things that we can do. The final one, and something that I've been working on for a long time, slacker that I am, is the Paid Vacation Act of 2009. It's actually a bill that I actually pretty much wrote for Congressman Alan Grayson of Florida. He submitted the bill last year. It's a very modest bill. I wanted to make it stronger, but he knew that it would be almost impossible to get anything through, much less any kind of strong bill. It provides roughly 1 to 2 weeks of vacation time by law for workers in companies with 50 or 100 employees and more. So it's just a start. There are only 5 countries in the entire world that do not guarantee at least some paid vacation time for their workers. In addition to the United States, the other 4 are Guyana. How many of you know where Guyana is? Anyone tell me where Guyana is? South America, right next to Venezuela. Suriname, where is Suriname? Right next to Guyana. This is a smart group. We got a lot of geography majors. Sometimes you've got this and people have no clue at all. The other 2, you know where they are, Nepal and that paragon of human rights, Burma. So those are it. You know, the United States and those 4 countries, the only countries in the world that don't guarantee at least some paid vacation time. I want to show you about 5 minutes of video, then turn this over to Dave to finish up the section here, but this is just a little video on why I think we need some vacation time in the United States, and I think it would be a valuable thing for health, for starting to begin to share work, and so
we need the screen.
John, you need the screen.
You need to get the, need the screen. Can someone turn on the projector? It's the little button on the front, it's the right side. Oh, it's okay. I think I'll be cool. Let's see. Once the projector is on. Should it go on?
Yeah, it's
good.
On.
Okay. Just take some time to go through the projector and warm up. Reminder, top 100 hours. Actually now about 300 hours.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be fun. Here we go. All right. Here we go.
In Yosemite National Park. Backpackers are already on the trail. Climb the mountains and get their good tidings, wrote naturalist John Muir of Yosemite's high country. Nature's peace will flow into you, and your cares will drop off like autumn leaves. Lynn Tron and Will Taylor share Muir's sentiments.
I felt everything last night, like draining away, like all the thoughts of the city and of work and everything.
This is phenomenal, just like this whole panoramic vista that you have, and our campsite is just awesome. You wake up to this. Fantastic.
They say they are lucky to be able to come here.
It's tough, you know? We come from a culture in America where everything is, you know, go, 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 you know? Keep up with the Joneses and make your life better.
Backpackers like Will and Linda have Upper Cathedral Lake nearly to themselves.
People are coming for a shorter amount of time. They're not taking the 2-week backpacking trips that they've done.
At Pines Campground in world-famous Yosemite Valley, solitude isn't part of the picture, but nature's magic is just as real.
You come up here and you can really relax, slow down, you know, a cup of coffee in the morning. Is it rushed?
We should get to your birthday first so we can have all the energy you need.
Coming together, breaking bread with family, cooking, hiking, swimming. I mean, these are life experiences the kids won't ever forget, because I know I didn't. I mean, one of the things they said when we were driving up yesterday, we get to see the stars tonight. And for city kids to say that, that's special.
The family vacation is an American tradition. Or at least it used to be. A third fewer families vacation together today compared with a generation ago. And children spend only half as much unstructured time outdoors. Even in Yosemite, many visitors barely leave their buses.
Over the last 20 years, the trend has been for more day use than overnight use. In fact, the average visit to Yosemite National Park right now is less than 5 hours. It affects people's behavior. People aren't stopping to look around or just to relax. They're rush, rush, rush. And I see that every day.
At Yosemite's most popular viewpoints, tourists snap quick photos and hurry on to the next must-see location.
And are in the restroom without a doubt.
People are here physically, but they're not actually quite here yet. You know, they're harried, they're rushed, they're looking at their watches. All those things keep them from actually being here. We should at the entrance station say, excuse me, sir, ma'am, do you have a clock with you? Well, yes, I do. You need to turn that in here.
At Happy Isle, a popular valley destination, Ranger Sheldon Johnson talks with tourists. Something he's been doing for 15 years.
So I got a question for you. How does it feel to you knowing that you know, much of our visitation of people from other countries, and a lot of those visitors will have like 2 months off.
I remember when I was a kid, I mean, we used to take, you know, 2-3 week driving vacations, and I look back and I wonder how my dad was able to get that much time off work.
Yeah, you know, in some sense, you'd like to trade salary for more time if you can.
I think for most of us, we've worked so much and we've worked so hard that we never even realize where we are and who we are. We're just so focused on what we're doing, which makes us like worker ants. We're just, you know, running around this, doing that, and we never stop and just go, hey, everyone, stop. Isn't that a beautiful day?
And it rings the first couple days, I've got to go to my pocket. I don't even have my phone, but I still think it's ringing. You know, it's kind of sad. I think it's more than you see of Americans here.
Okay, where are you from?
From Austria. So how much time is it?
I guess it's been here. Zoomies.
That's a lot of time.
Do you folks think that Americans get enough vacation time?
No.
Not really.
Now, why is it that you didn't even hesitate with it?
Well, I'm not on vacation because I preach that to my patients. They have to go away.
Back home in New Jersey, Arnold Play is a family physician.
Patients will come in and see you, and they're like bouncing off the wall, and you'll say, what's going on? When's your last vacation? Sometimes it could be 6 years or more. And you say, you know, maybe your vacation is what the person needs to do before you talk about therapy, medications, and things like that.
And then you have people who are working 3 jobs. Mm-hmm. So not only are they taking their time off, but they can barely make ends meet, and they're working
right.
3 different jobs and mm-hmm. don't even have a weekend off.
Mm-hmm. And maybe one of the presidential contenders who gets elected will have some way to force time off. Mm-hmm.
Your device is supported by many studies. Men who don't take regular vacations are 30% more likely to suffer from heart disease than those who do. For women, the number is higher at 50%.
We need to stop. Take a breath and ask ourselves, is this the direction we should be headed? In idleness, there is the opportunity for contemplation, there is the opportunity for soul searching, and for seeing, for really, truly, clearly seeing what's around us.
Well, one final word or two here, and then I'm going to bring Dave up. I showed you this so you'd all feel good about the fact that you're on vacation here at home, that you're going to spend time with your families, and where a cup of coffee doesn't feel rushed, and all of that. So you are doing your part for yourself and for the country and for everything in coming here. But I believe this is a real illness that we have as a society, that we don't do more of this, and that we don't pay attention. How many of you saw the big Ken Burns series on the national parks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you probably recognize Sheldon Johnson. He was one of the stars of that program, the ranger at Yosemite. And he was great when we worked with him. He just kind of said, well, I'll produce that for you. I'll take over. You don't have to interview the people. I'll do it. You know, it was great. So he went out and talked to him. And then the doctor, we met the doctor at the end purely by accident because he came and asked Sheldon the question. And and Shelton then asked him, you know, what do you think about Americans' vacation time? And the doc said what he said. And he, Arnold Belay, the former president of the New Jersey Family Medical Society, and he then got very excited about what we were doing around the Paid Vacation Act. And so when Congressman Grayson introduced the bill last year, and Congressman Grayson and I and Arnold Pillay and a couple of other people spoke in Washington at the introduction of the bill, and then we did some briefings for members of Congress around that. And so he was our doc. But he got so excited about this whole thing that he came down from New Jersey on his own dime, took time off work to testify. And it was purely the result of a chance meeting in Yosemite. So thank you for my part of this. I want to introduce Dave, and then at the very end, just say one final word. Go for it. Dave Backer, who is the host of, for those of you who didn't see What's the Economy For, anyway, Dave Backer is an ecological economist and was the host of the program.
Well, thank you, John. And talking about solutions and such and transition, I think this is one of the first and most important things. People have to get some control over their time, because if you think about all the things we've solved, whether it was just in U.S. history or even before that, it's a huge number of problems. It's rather mind-boggling, from lights to malaria, to not yet malaria, but the plague, etc. And all of that sort of does take some time. And one of the, and I would add one thing at the bottom here, and that's citizenship time. I think everybody, if you look back, I've been reading about economic history, and it's amazing the kind of movement in the 1920s and 30s and how many people spent so much time on so many different issues, even though they actually had less time in many ways prior to the 40-hour work week than we have even today. They worked on Saturdays full-time definitely at their jobs, and or full to half-time on their jobs. So, and then if you have some kind of goals, you like, I love John's suggestion, take time and see how you spend it and grade it, and maybe then have a goal, some measures, and what you would take as your own policies to kind of change your scene there, and whether it's your expenditures or your consumption and things like that. And I think that's a great thing to take place, to try out and kind of change things at a household level. But as we know, like, women didn't get the vote because everybody went, I'm gonna change things in my own house. And we didn't end slavery either, or, you know, change a whole lot of other 40-hour work week based on saying, okay, everybody's going to change things in their own household. And that's why the citizenship piece, I feel, is so important. And also, and I know that was kind of the goal of this film, is to say we need to get together as Americans, kind of reconceive things about how we want the economy and take action. And so just as part of that, I think everybody should think about how you dedicate a bit of time to the citizenship side in your community, with your church. It could be a national issue, stop corporations from having the ability to contribute to campaigns, you know, where there's an effort now for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to halt corporate campaigns, and that would be good, or maybe at the state and local level. And I just recently came on the board of our local conservation district in Pierce County, which is a lot of fun. And I was surprised at how big the budget is and all the things they're doing. And that doesn't take that much time, and it's been very enjoyable, actually. So I think change on the household level and then change at the national scale. And I'll just talk about a couple of these things more at the larger scale that you might think about, and a couple of other efforts. In the end, if we think about economic transformation, we have to change, okay. Take a step back. I skipped my outline here. So here on transformation at home, transformation on a national or larger scale as a citizen, and then also thinking about where you work and the time you spend there and how to change things. And I want to give just two examples on that case. Earth Economics, we worked with the spot prawn fishery, and this is a fishery off the west coast from Alaska down to California to catch these shrimp. And they're about this big, and they're called the spot prawn because they have three spots. And if you've ever seen in any restaurant, they have those tanks there with shrimp on them. They're virtually always the spot prawn shrimp. And initially, spot prawn were trawled for, so you drag a net across the bottom. In many areas, there's always been a kind of a traditional trap-caught fishery. But when you trawl them across the bottom, you get about 10 pounds of other stuff. They call it bycatch, and 1 pound of spot prawn. And that's, in fact, pretty destructive because you catch rockfish and all kinds of other things that will be valuable if they grow up. And so we worked with those fisheries, and surprisingly, the fishing industry were the first group to say, we need change. We want to make this fishery sustainable. We are interested in it. And so it was actually pretty easy to engage them. And so you think about where you work and what sustainability, how you can move, it might go a little more smoothly than you want. Because all of the fishermen in the spot prawn fishery are refugees from other collapsed fisheries. In any event, it took about 3 years, and trawling had already been phased out in British Columbia and Alaska, and then it was phased out in Washington State, Oregon, and California. And part of the secret was, if you catch a live spot prawn, rather than one that's been dragged around with rocks and other stuff, you get about $10 to $18 a pound rather than $3 a pound. And then if you look at the chain of custody of that shrimp, you can kind of increase value for everybody who's got it. And the thing is that I think there's a lot of opportunity to think about that in industries where we work. We also worked with 5 paper mills in Washington State, in Tacoma, Walla Walla, Port Angeles, Port Townsend, and Grays Harbor. So mostly very rural communities. And the paper mill said, wow, we used to have, you know, dozens of paper mills in Washington, said they went bust. And the big causes were price of energy, price of chips, and competition from overseas. And so we said, well, let's look at how you can green the operation. And overall, to make a very long story short, we set up, and again, goals, measures, policies. We worked with the paper mills, and they set up a suite of 30 different indicators, and they were very interesting indicators. Some of them were for the public, so does the paper mill stink too much? How many jobs does the paper mill provide? And then many were very technical, for instance, the toxic level of emissions and a variety of other things right there, very CO2 emissions and such. So there were social, economic, and environmental measures. And what was interesting about that in the process, they all kind of examined their production processes, and just a couple mills, by filling a few leaks in their giant compressors, saved maybe $20,000-$30,000 a year just on that. And out of that meeting came a proposal looking at education. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention about, I think that as I follow with that story, okay, let me finish that story first. We realized that chip prices go like this, up, down, just, it's a crisis. 1 year, everything's good in the paper industry with chips. The next year, they're all just about to die, and then it's down again, and then up. And then we looked at the state and went, oh, Washington State. You know, we had this brilliant thing in the 1880s. We decided we had lots of trees. We set aside a huge amount of land and said, we're going to fund schools with timber. And that worked really well when we had lots of timber and not too many kids. But now we don't have so much timber anymore, and we have a whole lot of children, and it doesn't cover the budget anywhere close to it. But also, those timber prices run really high, rock bottom low, really high, rock bottom low, every single year. And so then, out of this meeting with paper mills came a proposal that, hey, can't the state do better, and can't paper mills do better also if they had a long-term commitment for chips and sales and prices of chips? And so this is a discussion, but actually to do that, to have long-term pricing, which would be an average, so the state would not lose overall, in fact they'd probably do better, and paper mills also would have an assured chip source, you'd have to change the Washington State Constitution, because under the Constitution we're mandated to get the highest rate of return every single year off of those lands, and evening that out a little bit would be better for the state and education overall. But anyway, what I'm kind of pointing out is that as you get discussions, the nitty-gritty of sustainability and of economic transition is actually in how each industry and business really works. It's got a lot of details to it. So wherever you work, also, I think, you know, digging into that a little bit and how sustainability works and how that fits together is really important. These 5 paper mills, 3 of them, are just really interested in green products. They want to push green products big time. Simpson is a craft mill, so they produce paper that other say on the solution side, there are all these pieces where we can kind of act. And I think as a country, we need to start thinking about what kind of constitutional amendments even we need, whether it's stopping corporations from having the ability to contribute to campaign contributions, or our state constitutions. And there's a constitutional, we're working on the state, we need a few state constitutional amendments as well. And we've amended the Washington state constitution 102 times since 1898, so it's not that unusual. And what at the local level, but I kind of wanted to then just throw it out to folks to think about what ideas you've got also for solutions. There is a huge number of solutions we can kind of discuss further, but we probably only have a few minutes, right, John?
Yeah.
Okay, so what are some other ideas that you all have? I mean, what do you think about, you know, this home, work, and citizenship levels of action that we can take?
One thing, the whole business of waste. I mean, we're here, we're sitting, you know, talking about the tailings and everything. But you know, in our homes, I mean, some of us are, you know, what's happening with garbage and stuff in Seattle or other places. That's going to be an issue too in terms of energy. You know, how we can new ways to produce power. But I think for people as individuals, people in their churches, our places of work, you know, working on that is really important. I mean, it's part of, you know, the whole, you know, reduce, recycle. But I know right now, for example, just the day before I left to come up here, that Earth Ministry sent out an email said, you know, by July 23rd, you can submit proposal to get seed money of $2,000 to $3,000, for related to, it's under sort of the rubric of global warming, but one possibility was like around garbage and stuff, and you know, for churches and synagogues, and I think that's an important area.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. One thing we've done is, in our neighborhood, we don't have a garbage can. We just share with our neighbors, and then we treat them to dinner at a very nice restaurant every year. And we call it the Harold LeMay dinner because Harold LeMay is the founder of the garbage company. That's kind of fun. And on an international scale, this is where international cooperation fits too. There's a Basel Convention, and it's very interesting. Citizens from Denmark took this issue on. In fact, and Denmark was one of the leading nations in the Basel Convention to ban the trade in toxic waste. And that had a huge impact, because when you plug up the exhaust pipe on waste, suddenly people and industries clean up because they're forced to with costs. So yeah, I think, again, that kind of local to international is important. Yep.
Our church did an energy audit this year and last year. And we have a new one of our ministry teams is an environmental ministry team. And what we're really working at is awareness, because you can't force anybody to do anything. All you can do is make them aware. When they see the light bulbs change at church, and they see the energy level going down, and they see no more styrofoam cups and all this stuff, then it shows something without preaching. And I know stories are much better than, and showing are much better than just saying, do it.
Definitely, by example.
It's a DVD called Renewal that features faith communities. It's interfaith. That's a fabulous DVD that you can get. Just go look online, and it has a story about eight faith communities, and it deals everything from garbage to, you know, cups, you know, dumpster dive, and you have people get your kids involved in, you know, looking at what's in your dumpster and how can you, you know, change that, and I mean, it's a really renewal. That's just Google it, and it's really good.
Another thing. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Are you familiar with the book One World? It's a children's book by Bill Keith. He actually used to do cartoons for Disney, but it's a great children's book, and I started recycling that in my school because we didn't know recycling whatsoever, and I got a grant and implemented it and did a big birthday celebration. We're on TV and everything.
Say the title again.
It's called The Wump World, W-U-M-P, and it's by Bill Keith, and it's about these wumps who live on this planet. They're all happy, and they have pristine, clean waters, and they eat the trees, and it's just beautiful, and all of a sudden these spaceships come in, and the pollution from the planet pollute us, and it destroyed their planet, so they've come to this new, brand new
you know, running off into the caves, and they're under the caves and the caverns, and they hear all this noise, and they don't know what's going on above. And finally, everything quiets down because the air gets full of smog, and there's pollution, and they just pretty much pave everything, and it's very, very huge impact on children.
It's like the Lorax.
Great. Yeah, it sounds like it.
And then there's another one he writes called Farewell to Shady Glade, and it's about the impact on, you know, development taking away habitats for animals. And these little animals live in Shady Glade, and all of a sudden these bulldozers are coming, and they, you know, there goes their big tree, and they have to hop on the top of a train, and then they are looking for another place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of all a little community of animals. There's raccoons, frogs, and, you know, the frogs weren't going to go, but all of a sudden, you know, the tree's about to squish, and they jump on last minute. But it's Phil Pete, and he's a really, really good illustrator, as well as author, who writes a lot of environmental stuff.
That's great. And I think, you know, education of children is just so crucial and so critical. That's where sustainability is going to come from.
Yeah.
Can you repeat the title, because people there didn't hear?
Bill Pete's the author, P-E-E-T, and the first book is called The Wump World, and the pollutions from planet Pollutus come and destroy the planet, and then go off to destroy another one. And then the other one is Farewell to Shady Glade.
The DVD Wall-E,
Yeah.
Great. I mean, that's one that works for kids and adults at different levels. Show it at church.
But another thing about education, too, is, you know, with no sick leave, I mean, I teach first grade, and, I mean, there's so many kids come to school sick.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you don't look well. Are you feeling okay, sweetheart? They're like, no, my mom said to call if I don't feel well. And then Kathy's parents don't have cut phones or disconnected numbers. At the school I work at, you know, you can't reach anybody. And so the poor child, they're sick and infecting everybody, including me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the parent, you know, they have to go to work or whatever. So, you know, they can't take time off.
Yeah. That's why these things are all tied together. And let me throw out one other big thing in solution, which is certainly, or not solution completely, but something that's definitely unsolved. I was at the climate convention meeting in Denmark, and it was very interesting. And it was basically, in fact, China basically said, we will not sacrifice GDP growth for carbon reductions. We'll reduce, their commitment was to reduce their CO2 emissions per GDP unit. And if that doesn't say how grandiose and important the GDP is, even in a communist, officially a communist country, it's very interesting. But I think, and I've observed these meetings from 1991 to the present, and there's a huge, all these issues are there. Equity issue, you know, who gets to burn carbon and who gets to, et cetera, if we're going to put a cap on it. And so I would just throw out to you, and one thing that definitely has not come about yet is a global agreement to figure out exactly what to do, like carbon trading scheme or something else. But I think that one thing we can throw out together, what would you be willing to do to help meet those issues? Equity, carbon reduction, development in countries that don't have it, greater equity. What things, you know, you think you could do or we could do, even though we don't have some global agreement? Any discussion on that grandiose thought?
It's easier for us to do stuff locally.
That's true. One thing we did in our neighborhood, too, is we got our neighbors together and we said, okay, whoever's going to Trader Joe's or Costco, just, I'll give you my list, or if I go, I'll give me my list. I'm so happy with that, because I hate shopping. And I go like one-third of the time as much as I used to go, and it cut down all our gas and time and everything else. But
you mentioned LeMay.
Yeah.
And where we live, which is Lacey, LeMay shut down a lot of their recycling containers, because people were not recycling, they were using them for garbage.
Well, you know,
they're unattended. That is the casualty of your recycling program that they will be used for other than what we want them for. Successful recycling centers that I've seen in the Midwest and here are the ones that they pay for the attendant. And they recycle anything and everything that comes in the door. And they can even use it for a tenant that is on some program. But that increases, and plus you have to have a nearby by market for all the stuff. If you have to truck it 300 miles to get any money for it, you ain't going to make any money.
But this is a great example, because of course I know the whole LeMay thing. And they were just bought out, and so LeMay actually hired the attendants to be there. So they had the recycling, and the new company doesn't want to have recycling. And so they like got rid of the one attendant for a day of these giant things, and that's why they got garbage in there, and that's why they kind of want to ditch the recycling operation. And that's where I think the counties need to just say tough luck. You got to have recycling, period. And you need to pay some for somebody to be there and watch over it. So that I think that's a really interesting example. You know, you get a corporate change, but we had a question or comment.
I read an article of this person about Albert Lea, Minnesota. Years ago, they got a grant to become a healthy community. And one of the components of that was to get kids, get the community walking again. And so they set up some kind of program where parents or senior citizens would walk the neighborhood children to and from school. They got exercise, they did things intergenerationally, mm-hmm. and they said that it did amazing things for building the neighborhoods and with the community. And they did something beyond that too in terms of local food and how to eat healthfully. But that was one component.
That's great. And I think for maybe the biggest impact are land use changes. And so, you know, participation in local land use decisions and boards, that probably has more impact than almost anything else. I mean, you really have a lot of savings. Agriculture, history, housing, walkable communities, all those decisions.
Didn't San Jose or one of the California companies, cities have a huge program for a zero waste thing where they've absolutely recycled everything and used it in terms of, I don't remember which one, but it was a fairly impressive program of just a total recycling and total environmental awareness.
Probably. I saw one of those in Palawan, Philippines, and it's amazing because they separate everything. and it is like zero. Yeah, it is. Like the garbologist here. And it's zero waste is their target.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
We're kind of over time.
Okay.
Finally, Dave and I will be here until tomorrow afternoon. So if anyone wants to talk to us, please do. You know, come and corner us wherever we are.
Where are you on the boat?
Again, we'll be on the afternoon boat. And the resource list, if you haven't got it, has our contact info on the bottom. So, let us know what you're doing, if you have good ideas, because we'd actually love to hear from you. We're working on a book now, What's the Economy For Anyway? The book is due, our first draft of the book is due to the publisher on the 1st of October. So if you hear good things and stuff, by all means, send us a note, because we'd love to know about that.
The only other comment I have is, what is the solution for it? There are great ideas to have paid vacation, paid sick leave, paid maternity leave, and so forth for workers. And that's fine if you're IBM or Microsoft or something. What if you own a business and these mandates come up, paid health care, all of those four issues are very important issues, but a lot of companies are going broke as we talk, is it a government subsidized thing to do all that, or what's your vision for all of these workers' benefits?
Well, government really does need to help in many cases with the smaller businesses, but we do have somehow the idea that one of the things is if you make these things across the board, they actually they don't hurt as much as the current thing where the company that wants to do it feels like the other company will undercut them or won't do it at the same time. We tend to think that we can't do a lot of these things because we have a lot of small businesses, but in fact, the percentage of European workers who work for small businesses is much, much higher than the percentage of American workers who do. But I think some kinds of tax credits and other things to get this started would be valuable. I think that the evidence is very strong and clear that the same companies will find that these things are actually not only cost effective, but they increase productivity, they do a lot of positive things. And that's what we don't take into account enough. We don't understand, we understand sometimes the cost, but we don't understand the long run benefits. It costs a little higher, more to put in the good light bulb first, but you say the same thing with things like sick leave can save us a lot of money as a country. Better health is going to save employers because health premiums won't be so high. We have to think in a more holistic sense.
On healthcare, we have a responsibility as individuals to lose all our pounds.
That's right.
To health practices. That's the easiest way to try to healthcare costs down, not the government.
Yeah, although I have to say, you know, the OECD, on your point, Earth Economics, we're a small organization, we're a small business nonprofit, but we have 5 employees, and it's rough giving people health care because it takes a big bite out of the budget, and foundations don't want to give grants for overhead costs.
Yeah.
And so it's tough.
One or two of those 5 disappear on a maternity leave. Where does that leave you?
Well, it's tough, but we go ahead and do that, and what we've found, we haven't had anybody on maternity leave for the last few years here yet, but we probably will. But
at the same time.
Yeah, or if they all went at the same time, well, then we bring somebody on, and that's what we've done for vacation. But we make sure everybody takes their vacation and all. But I think, actually, if we had a system like the OECD says that the U.S. is at a competitive disadvantage because it doesn't have a health care like system like Europe or Canada, where you do have basically a sort of a single-payer system, and everything's covered for basic health care.
Yeah.
And if you had a system like that, it would take the burden off the small businesses. But for us, yeah, we have to think twice about hiring somebody.
Things like family leave, for instance, they're done by putting in California is the only state that has a really active paid family leave program. It's only 6 weeks, but it's really, you know, beneficial for moms and dads. Each parent can take 6 weeks, so for them to have that. And the way they fund it is that workers put in a matter of a couple of cents per hour into the thing. Business doesn't pay a penny for the California family leave program. Workers pay the cost. It's not much cost because not that many people are doing it. So, you know, of course, temporarily you have to find a replacement, and that can be an issue, but the businesses are not responsible for
that. I certainly agree with the shared burden concept. I mean, that makes a huge amount of sense. If you put that all on your employer, you have those 4 things.
Yeah,
you just can't stay in business.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, we need to make our priorities so that we support those kinds of things. You know, one of the big deals is, you know, where we give breaks and where we give subsidies. And these are some of the things that we ought to think about, because in the long run they will be effective. We know how much money the Canadians. Not only know how much money they save in children's health care costs because they do family leave, they can see it because they pay for it out of their health care system. And so they can see that when they went to a year of paid family leave, their overall health care costs dropped as a country. And they even talked about going to 18 months.
Well,
they're not going to do that
anymore. Any more handouts?